Fun Ideas Productions presents the Fun Ideas Podcast.
If you're unhappy most of the time, and you're indoors when the sun begins to shine, you're barred down with responsibility. When the good sun shines, you can come out with.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and welcome to Fun Ideas Podcast number 257. I will be at the Mid-Valley Comic Art Expo in Salem, Oregon on April 20th and 21st, and Shortbox Live in San Jose, California on May 5th, signing copies of my new Turtles book and new Mad books. How do you do? The purpose of this recording is to introduce you to my new book set called Unconditionally Mad, Part 1 and Part B. First, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Mark D. Arnold, and I am the writer of Unconditionally Mad. It's my job. I am the writer of Unconditionally Mad, and it's my job. What's so funny about that? Well, anyway, here's William M. Gaines, Harvey Kurtzman, Jack Davis, Wally Wood, Bill Elder, Al Feldstein, Norman Mingo, Kelly Freeze, Bob Clark, Frank Jacobs, Don Martin, Don Edwin, Paul Coker, Nick Meglin, Dave Berg, George Woodbridge, Mort Drucker, Al Jaffe, Dick DeBartolo, Sergio Aragonés, Angelo Torres, Tom Bunk, John Ficarra, Tom Richmond, Desmond Devlin, Sam Viviano, Johnny Sampson, Bill Morrison, Susie Splab, and many more. And here's the publisher, Bear Manor Media. Available now through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Bear Manor Media. The Fun Ideas Podcast is brought to you in part by Freaky Magazine. I contribute material to every issue, so give it a try.
Hey, kids. Have you read Freaky? The magazine of weird humor for freaks like you. Freaky Magazine is a way-out collection of weirdo comics, kooky gags, photo funnies, social satire, and surreal collage. 52 pages of insanity in the tradition of magazines of yore like Cracked, Plop, and Zap. Special offer for Fun Ideas listeners, get a free sample copy in the mail, made of smelly newsprint and smudgy ink the old-fashioned way. Just message your mailing address to theslowpoisoner@gmail.com. That's theslowpoisoner@gmail.com while supplies last.
Friends, have you tried Lee's Comics? Lee's Comics is better than the leading comic book store. Wait a minute. Lee's Comics is the leading comic book store, based on arbitrary standards set by Lee Hester himself.
Lee's Comics was named as one of the 21 best online dealers by PopOptique.com. To shop the Lee's Comics eBay store, go to eBay and search for Lee's Comics, Inc. That's LEESCOMICSINC, period. Don't forget the period. Mention the Fun Ideas Podcast when you order, and you'll receive a free bonus gift.
Hey, hey, it's Charles Rosenay from the Monkees Interview Show here on Monkey Mania Radio. So proud to announce the release of a brand new book called Not Just Happy Together, The Turtles from A to Z. That's right, the other band besides our monkeys who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, The Turtles, a great new book that's a discography. It's got interviews, it's got reviews, it's got everything you might want to read about. if you're a 60s fan like I am and love the Beatles and the Monkees and the Turtles, not just Happy Together has a front cover and a back cover by Henry Diltz, a foreword by Gary Puckett, and it's published by Genius Music Books, an imprint of Genius Book Publishing, now available from www.notjusthappytogether.com. Hope you pick it up. I know you're going to love it and enjoy all the stuff about the Turtles. Thank you for listening to Monkey Mania Radio. Hey, hey.
In Fun Ideas Productions news, Unconditionally Mad Part 1 and Part B are out, as is Not Just Happy Together, The Turtles from A to Z, AM Radio to Zappa. Currently, I'm working on TV cartoons that time forgot, and a new book called The Magazine That Dared to Be Dumb, The History of Crazy Magazine. All of my books are available through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and most are available through Bear Manor Media. The Turtles book is through Genius Publishing. On today's show, we have a video game designer and author of books about video games. Here he is, Scott Rogers.
Hi, this is Mark Arnold, and it's another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. And today on the show, we have a video game designer and author, and his name is Scott Rogers, and I want to learn more about what you do. So welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. It's nice to be here.
Now, where do you hail from? I'm in Springfield, Oregon myself. So,
I am in Thousand Oaks, California, just okay. About an hour north of Los Angeles.
I know where that is. Yeah. let's see. So, you kind of came in, like I said, free to the show, kind of in a different way than what I usually do. Usually I know a lot about my guests, and today I'm like, ooh, I got to find out who this person is. But you were willing to be interviewed, but, you know, you've done a lot of different things. And so I guess the main question, you know, the two books that I see that you've done, you might have done more, is you did Your Turn, The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design, and then the other one is Level Up, The Guide to Great Video Game Design.
And I have a third book called Swipe This, The okay. Guide to Great Touchscreen Game Design.
Okay.
I call it my exclamation mark trilogy.
So how did you get started in all this in the first place?
In gaming or writing books?
Both.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, In gaming, I was discovered in a coffee shop like Lana Turner. I had gone to school for film and art. I have degrees in illustration and screenwriting. And so I thought I was going to be working most likely in the film industry as a screenwriter or concept artist or storyboard artist or something like that. And a friend of mine from college came up to me and said that his business was looking for people to work for him. And they were using a specific type of program called Deluxe Paint and Deluxe Animator, which I didn't have familiarity with. But he very kindly lent me his computer and these programs. And I taught myself, created a reel. And I went in and interviewed with this company. And they said, well, we like your stuff and we like you, but unfortunately we just gave this position away. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, no worries. Good luck, you know, with your future endeavors. And that little company, they changed their name and ended up being called Blizzard, who you might have heard of, a big video game company. So I missed being the 16th employee of Blizzard by that much. But I had a reel and I applied for a job at another company. And I ended up working as an artist for a couple of years, but I found that this was back in the 16-bit days, so the Sega Genesis and the Super Nintendo. And creating art in those days was you had to do it pixel by pixel, which I found to be a very laborious process. It was a bit like laying bathroom tile, and I wasn't happy doing art. I didn't feel I was given a chance to create anything very artistic. And one day I heard some laughing over the other cubicle and I peeked my head over and there were all the game designers yucking it up. And I'm like, those guys are having way more fun making games than I am. Maybe that's what I should be doing. So I marched over to them and I said, how do I become a game designer? And one of the fellows there, a fellow named Bill Anderson, took me under his wing. And that's how I started to become a game designer.
Hmm. Did he teach you everything that you needed to know, or did he say go to school and we'll see you in 6 months or whatever?
Well, first of all, there were no video game schools back when I and there were barely any books. Most of the books were things like, you know, a book about Sonic the Hedgehog, you know, and kind of in the in between of all the, you know, promotion for Sonic the Hedgehog, there were things, you know, occasionally there were things like, here's a picture of, you know, Sonic and this how we do it in 16-bit art. So you had to kind of do some archaeology to discover. Really, mainly how I learned to do the art was I played video games and I would freeze frame them and look at the artwork, and you could see the pixels, you know, individually. And I kind of figured out from there, oh, this is how they're doing this, or, you know, they're making these shapes and, you know, and things like that. So, but the game design, I learned, he taught me a fair amount. Back in these days, we would do a lot of like platforming games and things like that. So he taught me about, you know, the do's and don'ts. And I ended up, as part of the deal, I essentially did his homework for him, which was he would say, hey, I, you know, my boss has asked me to do this. Hey, I need you to do this, you know? So, so there's a lot of, drawing, because I was an artist, I would draw level maps and I would draw out gameplay design and I would draw out storyboards and things like that. And a lot of them were the storyboards and things like that were things I already knew how to do from filmmaking. But a lot of the other way, the techniques of making levels and mainly kind of what the do's and don'ts, he gave me a real good foundation. And then a lot of it came later from me playing games and looking at how they worked and kind of creating my own lexicon of, you know, goods and bad things and what I call my utility belt full of tricks and tips, you know, like things that I observed over the years. And when you play something, you know, you develop a sense of taste, what you like and what you don't like. And so this eventually became the material that went into my books.
I see. Now, your books, do they focus on the type of game design you were doing at that time, or do you also talk about how things have progressed and improved over the years?
Sure. So Level Up is in its second edition. So it does have, it's somewhat updated, but I'm working on a third edition right now that needs, because the industry has changed. It changes drastically, probably about every 5 years. And the book is now about in publication. The second edition has been in publication for like 10 years. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I went to my publisher and I said, hey, shouldn't we be updating this? You know, things are changing and there's a lot of new things like VR and AR and monetization. I mean, some of that is touched on in Level Up, but I definitely feel like there's a lot of topics that need to be discussed. And at the time my publisher was like, look, your book's making a lot of money. Don't mess with it.
Right.
So on one hand I was enjoying the royalty checks, but on the other hand, now I'm like, I definitely feel like it needs to be updated. So I'm in the process of doing that. Your Turn just came out. That came out in October. And that's pretty up to date. Actually, it's even a little ahead of date. There are some things that are referenced in it that haven't even come out yet. But they're both meant to be useful guides for the creative individuals that are making these types of products. This year I went through some health issues, and as a result, I heard back from a lot of people who have told me what an impact Level Up made on their lives. Stories like, there was a fellow in Italy who said, there's no such thing as a game design program here in Italy, but I bought your book and it gave me enough of a impetus to start working in games. And now I'm making my own games. Or a gal who said, I used to be in the army and I didn't like it. And I told my family I wanted to do video games and they all kind of laughed at me, but my mom bought your book and that gave me the start that I needed to now work in video games. So I heard a lot of really lovely stories from people about how Level Up has, you know, helped them on their career and positive, you know, feedback about the book, you know, that they really liked it and you know, found and find it useful on a regular basis. So that's kind of the fact that it's, you know, it's a guide to great video game design. And the guide part, I think, is really the most important, which is it's meant to be something that you keep on your shelf. And every so often you go, let me look, you know, in the book and see if there's something helpful that's applicable to what I'm working on, or let's see what Scott had to say about this or whatever. Right. So that's, that's a big part of what the books, they're very meant to be very practical, helpful books to the creators of these, of both video games and board games.
And is that what the third one, what was the third one again?
Oh, the third one is Swipe This, and that's for touchscreen, touchscreen and anything with movement. So at the time when I wrote it, the Wii was very a big system, and iPhones were just starting to become a thing, you know, a popular medium for you know, gaming. And so that's what those books are about. They're about the anything that requires a motion or you know, some sort of tactile interface. That's that's where the Swipe This is from. You know, you're swiping your finger, right? And that's
right.
That's the what the book's about.
Makes sense. Okay. What do you think is the biggest change? I mean, I, as a consumer, I've seen big changes, but what do you think is the biggest change or changes? You can make it plural over the years in video games.
Well, I think that a big change came with mobile, which is the lowering of prices of games. I mean, mobile literally were giving games away for free. They still do to this. I mean, you know, they charge you on the back end, right? If you if you want to, you know, get a power up or a special skin or participate in a certain event or something like that, you have to pay. But the upfront, you know, charge is free, right? You can download it for free and get started for free. And it really changed the industry. And I almost say not for the better, because games are expensive to make. And game developers deserve to get paid for the work that they do. And even the money that a game costs, $60 or $80 or, you know, so whatever, a 30, usually it's about 30 or 40 now. That money is not enough to pay for for the development, right? Like you, the industry has been hit very hard this year and last year, late last year, early this year. A lot of companies were laying off people. There's a lot of change going on in the industry. And part of it is, I think, due to the audience expecting games, they expect to be given games. Right. And I think that that's unfortunate, because that's a big mistake. That was a big mistake to give games for free. It was because, like I said, they're expensive to make. They're even a simple game like a Match 3 game or a Flappy Birds or something like that, it still, you know, has man hours and sweat equity and all that going into it. And you know, whoever said, I mean, it's a good gimmick to get people to get your game. Sure, it's free. I'll what the hell? How can I resist? But on the other hand, I think that it's a hurtful thing to the industry.
Now, through the years also, have games gotten easier to design, or because they get more complex? It's kind of a weird paradox as a viewer, you know, because it's like they get more and more elaborate, but it might be easier to make. You know,
it totally depends on the game. It totally depends on the audience. Certain types of games are benefit from being easier. So, for example, in the board game world, party games benefit from being easier. If you can explain a party game in like, you know, two or three sentences and everything else is self-explanatory, then you've got a winner. But there are other games, particularly, again, I'm talking about the analog board game world, that demand to be more complicated. And so you have, you know, all types of Euro-style games that kind of are complex and have lots of moving parts. You have a lot of thematic games that have story, so they have kind of a lot of content for the player to get through and rules to deal with. And you have a character that you're dealing with and leveling up. You have a world, you know, set of rules for different activities that require different actions. Sometimes they're dice related, sometimes they're card related, sometimes they're some other method. So these types of games, these more complex gamer games, are not always good for the general public. Like if you go to a Target or a Walmart, you'll start to see some of these games they've crept into over the past 5 or 10 years. But the really hardcore stuff is still only at like game shops. In video games, again, it's there's this struggle between complexity and non-complexity. You have games like, things like, what's that game where you're the little guy racing? Anyway, you have like party games like the Jackbox games or things like that that are relatively simple. And they're meant to be because, again, they're party games. But then you have more complex things. For example, I was playing Monster Hunter with my son, and there's a lot of complexity, the different actions you can do and the different tools and resources that you can interact with and use during the game. And so I was using a keyboard, and I was finding myself like just going all over the place, right, with my fingers, trying to, I don't have the dexterity of my 20-year-old son anymore. And so, he's going through and going, hey, why aren't you doing this? And I'm like, hey, give me a second. I have to put my fingers in the right place in order to be able to access it. Give me a second. It's I'm not as nimble as you are. So that's okay. It's okay for games to be simple. It's okay for them to be complicated. It just depends on the audience. And as a gamer, you start to know what type of game you like. So for me, I like stuff and I admire the complicated stuff, but I don't find myself gravitating towards it. I find myself kind of in the middle of the spectrum and then easing over to the easy stuff. But if something is too easy and mindless, then I lose interest and I don't want to play it either. So it's a lot of it, I think, has to do with what mood you're in. You might just be in the mood for solitaire or a simple word game or something like that. But on the other hand, you might be in the mood for something more complicated or challenging.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite games over the years? And you can even go back to Atari days or Pong or whatever. I don't care.
I love the arcade game Dig Dug. Because I find it very charming. The music is great. The gameplay is pretty fast paced, but not so fast paced that it's impossible. I really enjoyed the game Dragon's Lair, the one with the the animated character, just because it was gorgeous. And that and Space Ace are really way ahead of their time in terms of visuals, but very simple. Gameplay, right? Very much what is now called quick timer events essentially is what Dragon's Lair and Space Ace was. I am a big fan of Donkey Kong Country on the SNES, which is a platformer. I love Little Big Planet, which is also a platformer on the PlayStation 2. I love Team Fortress 2, which is a first-person shooter. It has a lot of personality to it. I really like Marvel Snap, which is a pretty recent card game. I like Slay the Spire, which is another type of card, digital card game. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to board games, I really love a game called Betrayed House on the Hill, which is a horror-themed game where you lay down tiles and create this mansion. Mm-hmm. And because of the fact that it's all, any order... The castle or the house forms in a variety of unusual ways every time you play it and creates a very cool emergent story for the player.
Now, when you come to designing games, do you try to design games in the style of what you like, or are you more on, we need a game like this? Okay, I'll deliver that. I mean, how does it all work?
I do both. As a professional board game designer, for example, I have been fortunate enough to work with several big name companies that have hired me to create designs. So, for example, one of the games I designed was called Alien: Fate of the Nostromo. It was based on the 1979 horror movie, and in that one, they said, "Okay, we want you to make this game based on this movie." And we have a couple of requests. One is you can't kill off the other players during the game, and you can't have a traitor mechanic. And I said, guys, you realize the movie Alien is about killing off all the other players and a traitor mechanic, right? And they're like, ah, you'll make it work. So I said, okay, I'm a professional. So I went ahead and designed it, but I thought turned out to be a really good game. And it's got a lot of positive feedback and sold really well. Mm-hmm. And then another one that was more recent was I was asked to do a game based on the movie The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And mm-hmm. I was like, guys, I've never really seen this movie. I'm too much of a scaredy cat to go see it. And the guy, Chris Zeffro at Trick or Treat Studios, was like, don't be such a chicken. Just go watch the movie. And I watched the movie and I'm like, okay, it's not as bad as I thought it was. And yeah. But I was also able to understand, you know, I was like, okay, I see what the game is here. You know, it's these kids and they are looking for gas and they need to escape, you know, not get caught by the bad guys. But the other thing I do is if I'm like Alien, I was a big fan and I had been a big fan since 1979. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because I wasn't familiar with it, and I also wasn't watching horror movies in the theater in 1973, I was too young. I instead went online, and I really, when I make these kind of movie games, I really want to understand why people love the movie so much. And so I would go online, and I would look at websites, and I would look at Reddit pages about the movie and things like that, and find out, what did people really love about the movie? Because when I make these games, I want the player to, if they're a fan, they're going to buy it if they're a fan. Right. And I want their expectations to be met, because that's what I would want as a fan of different things. If I pick up a certain game, I'm going to be like, yeah, this feels like the thing I love. Or it doesn't, you know, if it's not good, I'm like, it doesn't feel, it just feels like it's what's called pasted on, right? And so this is true for any type of game, video game or board game or whatever, is that you want to be true to the source material. I've made SpongeBob SquarePants games. I've made the doll Bratz. I've made Warhammer 40K. I've made, let's see, what are some other existing IP? A lot of Pixar movies. So when we make these games, you know, you have to know, you have to watch the movie. You have to do your research. Because you want to make something for the fan, and that's only fair.
Mm-hmm. Do they have a lot of input into it besides what you said? I mean, you said we want a game that, you know, doesn't kill everyone. But I mean, if you design something, do they like bug you to death with little tweaks and changes?
Bug me. It's meant to be a partnership, right? With the publisher. In board gaming, if you get the right publisher, then you get somebody who also cares enough to make the game better. So one of the other games that I've designed is called Pantone the Game, and it's a party game about creating characters out of these color swatches, and then the other people are guessing what the character is. And my original design of it was only one method. I had it where it was like, okay, put down three cards and try to guess who the character is. And the publisher of the game said, you know, we like this, but we feel like it needs a little more. And so they recommended, hey, let's do three rounds. And they suggested, how about we let them use everything? And I'm like, that's great, because everybody already is like, we want to use everything. So that fits in fine with what playtesting has proved out. And then they suggested a second one that said, how about you use one card of any color. And I'm like, oh, that's great. That's a nice limitation, but it's also a nice ramping of the gameplay. And so they also contributed, they came up with a really nice kind of a box for the color cards to sit in. So when you pull it out, you'd see all these colors. Mm-hmm. And so those were things that wouldn't have been made if not for the project manager's name was Deacon Wheeler. And he was the one, he was a great partner. He was a great person to work with and came up with some great ideas that definitely improved the game. And so if you're lucky, you have that. If you're not, then you have somebody who kind of doesn't care and, or is very draconian in what their demands are. Usually, often that is more the IP holder, where they say you can't do certain things. So for example, in SpongeBob SquarePants, we had a character. We had the Patrick Star, who was the starfish. We had his weapon in this one little game for the DS. He had an ice cream cone, and he would fling the ice cream off of it, and the splotch of, you know, the scoop of ice cream would go flying off and hit the bad guys and make them go away. Mm-hmm. And Nickelodeon, the company who owns SpongeBob, got back to us and said, you can't have SpongeBob or Patrick eating the ice cream all the time, because we have we're very much into anti-child obesity. Child obesity was like a big thing at the time. And so they were like, we don't want to show Patrick eating the ice cream, because that just means he's constantly eating ice cream. And we were like, first of all, we never show Patrick eating the ice cream. He's using it as a weapon. And they're like, well, that doesn't matter. And I said, okay, what do we do instead? And they said, how about you have him, you can keep the chocolate ice cream scoop, but you can have him scoop up dirt and him fling like a dirt ball. And I said, well, this isn't going to be good, but let's just make it anyway. Now, part of the problem was wherever Patrick was, it wasn't always dirt. It was lots of other types of ground environments. So it was, say he was on concrete, it would be dumb for him to scoop up, you know, a dirt wad and throw it, right? It didn't make as much sense. But the real thing happened, which I was like, I know this is going to happen, but I'm going to rub their noses in it, is that whenever he scooped through his legs, it looked like he was grabbing a ball of crap and throwing it at the bad guys. Oh, and they saw that and they were horrified. And I said, I said, how about I change it back? And they're like, he's fine. Give him the ice cream cone.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can, you know, based on what you know, you just have to prove it out sometimes to these people. And in that case, it ends up making a good story at the very least. But it was aggravating at the time, because we're dealing with these people that are like, come on, guys, you just don't get it.
Right. I assume video game design at this point is so sophisticated that you could probably design almost anything,
anything is possible. There are certain genres of games that I feel have been sorely neglected or just don't really show up yet. And I'm curious why. And it's something that I've been exploring just kind of on my own, mostly actually through tabletop, because tabletop, you can make anything in tabletop that can get turned into a video game, like the paper, essentially we call it paper prototyping. And so if you paper prototype something out, some sort of gameplay, any type of gameplay can be paper prototype, from a match three to a RPG. I feel that both the genres of romance, you know, like a romantic comedy or something like that, which is, you know, of course, super prevalent in other forms of fiction, and comedy, I think, you know, like a sitcom. I think these are two genres that the game industry, like funny, there aren't a lot of funny games out there. And there's definitely not a lot of games about romance. Now, there's dating games, but a lot of them are kind of creepy. In Japan in the 90s, it was kind of a big thing for a while. And there's some games that include romance. In certain ways, usually it has to do with like, hey, there's a girl in town. If I bake her a pie, then maybe I can get her to like me, you know, this kind of stuff. But nothing that really like deals with the emotional depths. And also, you know, the chance that you could fail, right? Like the rejection, you know, of a romance, that delicate balance of, you know, starting a relationship. And so I think that that's a genre, both of those are genres that really more developers should look to, because I think that there's a big audience for them myself. Now, like I said, it's not to say, you know, your audience might be wagging their finger at me and go, well, but what about this game? What about that game? And yeah, there are a lot of new, like indie developers are kind of edging into those territories. But we haven't seen a big breakthrough hit. You know, there's no Call of Duty game about, you know, sitcom or a Fortnite of romantic comedy or anything like that. And that's what I would love to see, is something reach that level of popularity that these other games, mostly shooter games, get.
Right. I know for myself, you know, I don't play a lot of video games anymore, but, you know, and back in the day when I used to a lot more, it was more the humorous type of things, you know,
you mentioned
Dig Dug, you know, as an example, you know, and even like Burger Time and things that.
They're silly.
You know, even Donkey Kong, just go basic, you know, or Pac-Man, you know, it's like there's a little sense of humor to it, whereas it got so like Worlds of Warcraft-ish and everybody shooting everything all day.
Everything it got in so damn serious, right? Yeah, like the industry took themselves a little too serious. And so, you know, fun things and silly things were for kids and everything else was for adults. And, you know, if it wasn't, you know, sarcastic or ironic, then it wasn't in those type of games.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ones I remember my dad had on his computer, and it was the low tech version because I think they improved it years later. But I always liked the low tech version of Leisure Suit Larry.
I mean, that was Leisure Suit Larry. You know, it's all right. It's very dated. There's things about it that are like pretty cringy, but I think it was an important experiment, and it was popular. I mean, you know, there were 5 or 6 of them, you know, a lot of sequels. So that's obviously the means they're successful. But yeah, it again was, I think it was a very interesting experience. There weren't a lot of games like that out there. But this was back, Leisure Suit Larry is more of from the era of adventure games, right? Like the 80s, you know, computer games like the Monkey Island games or the King's Quest or, you know, whatever these, you know, kind of story, there were more story based type games. And so you occasionally would see some very different genres of things. You know, there were probably some romance games back in that era.
Yeah.
But the problem was at that time I was a 15-year-old boy, so I wasn't interested in that. You know, I wanted to play games with ninjas and pirates and you know, stuff like that.
And I did my share of that too, but I'm just saying the type that sticks out in my memory of just, you know, that was kind of fun. And it's sometimes, you know, that's something that gets forgotten. It even, you know, you cross genres or into other things like comic books and stuff like that. It's like, I always think that's part of the comic book thing that they've kind of lost. It's all serious, gritty superheroes. And it's like, you know, what about the ones that had a little bit of fun, you know? It's
I'm a very big Batman fan. And I've been reading the book since, you know, I could read. And yeah, it's the last 5 or 10 years, it's just been so grim, right? It's everything is just very grim. And I'm like, I live for the moments, the little moments where, you know, maybe Batman hugs, you know, Damian, you know, because of something that happened, or I'm like, just show me any sign of humanity in this character that I love, you know,
right.
It's something again. Yeah. I think that culturally we have definitely, we've become very jaded and we've also, I think, lost a bit of our sense of wonder, because we see the fantastic so much now. I mean, particularly with, you know, AI art, I think that the fact that you can kind of visualize anything really kind of sucks a little bit of the imagination out of people, right? Yeah. Like, you know, the good old days where you would read a book and you would have your own mental version of what a character looked like. But then if it gets made into a, you know, a multi-million dollar movie, you no longer have to want, you know, you now have a image of Orlando Bloom as Legolas or, you know, whatever, any of the, you know, Harry Potter kids or whatever, right? Like, and you know, there's that delightful term that, you know, younger generation came up with, which is headcanon, you know, the things that are valid to your own mythology and not valid. And that's how I am with Batman. Batman, there are certain things where I'm like, yeah, this is part of my mental mythology. And then, you know, there might be another storyline and I go, nope, that's not going into the headcanon. You know, it's an interesting phenomenon for fans to, you know, it'd be interesting to like crack open a fan's brain and see like what stuck and what didn't, because then that you would, I think you would really get some good insight into how to make something, right? Oh, let's make more of this and less of that, because you know people are responding to this. That's the other thing, is I'm going back and reading the old 1980s G.I. Joe comics right now, by Larry Hama. And these are really, you know, they're really good comics, but they're also, what I'm really kind of surprised by is how mature they are for something based on, you know, a child's toy, right? Like a 3¾-inch action figure, but they're having, you know, these pretty deep dramas. But what I love the most is reading the letters page, where the fans would write in and either tell the writers that they're terrible or how wonderful they are, something like that. And it's really interesting to see kind of over time what things have, you know, kind of become elevated and whatnot. And there's one thing in particular, which is there's a certain issue, issue 21 of the series, which is a silent issue. It's a story about Snake Eyes going to rescue Scarlet from Cobra and Storm Shadow. And there's a whole bunch of, it was my big first introduction to ninjas and stuff like that. So that was part of the reason why it stuck with me. And I loved it from the start. But in the letters page, when I would read it, people are like, that was a terrible issue. There were no words in it. I read it in 10 seconds. You know, you're robbing me of, you know, because there's no dialogue in it. And I read some interviews later with Larry Hama, and he was like, yeah, they hated that book when it first came out. But I personally, my own belief is, I think it's maybe one of the 10 greatest comic books ever published. It's just, it's beautifully drawn. It's beautiful. The story is told masterfully. And everything that those fans hated about it are all the things that I love about it. So it's really fun to, because of those letter pages, I've been getting some really interesting insight into the you know, the book and the fans' reactions. And they also, what's fun is they bring up the toys too. So I'm a fan of the toys, so it gives me a very interesting perspective on what people were thinking back then.
Right. Shifting gears a little bit, just back to what we were originally talking about, because this question was on my brain from the beginning. What games have you designed that we would know? And do you take sole credit, or do you work on with a team?
Well, first of all, no game is designed by itself, right? Okay. That would just be hard. That would be hugely egotistical of me to say, oh yeah, I did it by myself. No, there's, so particularly in video games. Video games is you can't do it without a huge team. You know, the teams range in size anywhere from, you know, a small team is like usually three to five people, but a large team can be in the hundreds, if not thousands, depending on the scope of the game. Myself, the games that people would probably know are God of War is one of the most famous ones that I've worked on. I did a series called Maximo for Capcom. Mm-hmm. I did a game called Pac-Man World for Namco, which just recently got re-released. A game called Miss Pac-Man Maze Madness. Like I said, lots of SpongeBob SquarePants, lots of Bratz, Warhammer, a game called Darksiders. So those were a lot of games that were what are known as AAA games. Oh, a game called Soul Blade, which became a fighting game called Soul Calibur. So these were all AAA games that ended up making millions of dollars. I added them up one time. Like, I'm like, I wonder how much the games that I designed personally, how much money they made. And it was somewhere in the neighborhood of like $4 billion. Now, did I see any of that $4 billion? Not really. I got a nice paycheck, and occasionally I would get like a nice jacket. But other than that, no, I did not, get a royalty from any of those games. The board games that I designed, like I said, I mentioned Alien: Fate of the Nostromo and Texas Chainsaw. I also designed a game called Ray Guns and Rocket Ships, which was featured in a documentary from 2020 called Game Master. I did Pantone the game, and then I did two expansions for the game Villainous. Which is I did the Marvel versions. I did I did the Venom expansion, and I did the Dr. Octopus character from the latest release called Twisted Ambitions. But again, all of these were done with other people. Like the Villainous expansions were done with the creative director at Ravensburger. His name's Mike Mulvihill, and he's a really great designer. He's been around for a long time. And all of these other games, I had developers helping me with the games and making them better. Thank goodness, you know.
Now, how long does it take to do? I know we already talked about this earlier, but some are more complex than others. But how long on average does it take to design a game?
Well,
Either board or video, actually.
Right, right. So, it depends on, like, some of the games that I've designed have taken years to design, partially because I always carry a notebook with me, and I'll write down my ideas in them. And so maybe it'll start as a very nascent idea and grow and grow and grow and grow until I finally put it together. And I talk about this process in Your Turn and how you can do it yourself when you have an idea and what you can do with it. And but others. So, for example, recently I was asked by a company. They said, hey, we have this IP. Do you think you could design a game for it? And so I looked at the IP and I said, yeah, I can design a game for it. And I came up with the design and got it to them. And that took maybe a couple of weeks maybe to do. But that's just for the initial design. That's not actually building the game. I'm in the process of waiting to hear back from them to go, hey, guys, did you take a look at this? And, you know, did you like it? And you know, we can go from there. So it can be very short. Pantone, literally, I think I designed it in the actual design of it in like a week, less than a week. And then I play tested it for several months. And then I sold it to actually, I sold it to somebody first. They weren't able to publish it because they pivoted on what their strategy was. So I brought it to a convention and then somebody else bought it. So. So yeah, that's another thing that can happen, right? With your, at least with board game designs, video games designs, usually you make it, you find somebody to sell it to. And making video games is a little bit more like making a movie, where board games is a little bit more like selling a book. And there's a lot of, you know, the way that the publishing and the production works in those, then it can be very different. Or sometimes there's a lot of things that are the same. There's a lot of crossover. And that's why my books are meant to be evergreen, in the sense that there's a lot of truths that will, you know, if you know how to design, that doesn't change. Designing the basics of designing a game doesn't change over time. They're still the same. Now, the types of games might change. And they might bring new things to the party, but still the fundamentals apply.
Yeah, which I guess leads to my next question then is, so the fundamentals is the basic gameplay, right? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, the ideas of game design, right? The basic tenets of doing things that, you know, the players enjoy. You want the player to feel like they're succeeding. You don't want them to ever feel like they fail. You don't ever want to stop the game, you know, and have, you know, like a lose a turn, or those are very old fashioned game design things. And a lot of young designers will add those in because they only know those types of old games. You know, I'm talking about games like Monopoly and Candyland and things like that. Right. Those are they're not the oldest games. There's, you know, there's games thousands of years older than that. But these are kind of the ones that if you say board game, what will pop into mind? Well, my money is always either on Candyland or Monopoly. Like if I say, you know, think of a board game, most likely people will name this too. Although, you know, I did this not too long ago. I asked about like 75, 80 people this question just to see where their brain was at. And now granted, you know, some of them were friends, so they were gamers, but others sometimes would say Cards Against Humanity, or they'd say Catan, or they'd say, you know, they would bring up more modern games. And so that to me, at least, what I was trying to find out is how up to date are people with their knowledge on games. And it was good to see that people are starting to learn and starting to try new things other than these kind of old, not so fun. You know, when have you ever had a good time playing Monopoly, right?
Right. And it's funny that you brought that up. You know, years ago when I was still living in California, I used to live in Northern California. And I assume they still have this, but now I'm married and everything else, so I don't really do this as much. But there used to be meetup groups.
Yep.
And I was living in the South. I was living in the South Bay, but there's a meetup group in San Francisco, which, you know, is like an hour away. It's not that bad. Sure. But I was using it ostensibly to meet women and stuff like that. But, you know, at the same time, you know, my knowledge of board games at the time was very limited to what you're saying. The old school stuff that just like Monopoly and Sorry and what are the older ones, Clue and all that stuff.
Sure.
You know, and it's like, geez, I got to learn some of these newer games here, you know. And, you know, so I was introduced to some of the ones you were saying there and, you know, which now are kind of older and stuff. But at the time, you know, there were new like apples to apples and things like that. Sure. And so it's like, you know, I probably need to venture out and do this again just to get even more up to date and what's going on. But I tend to love board games more than video games anyway, just because of the tangible bit of
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, as much as I love video games and have made a career out of video games, I adore board games. I love the tactility of them. I love rolling dice. I love moving miniatures. I like laying down tiles. There are digital equivalents. There's some tools like Tabletop Simulator and Tabletopia and things like that. And those are fine. There's tons of people playing games on those. And it's a good way, particularly during the pandemic, it was a great way and the only way really for people to play games together. But for me, it removes what I love most about games, and that's that tactility. To your point about gaming groups, those are fantastic. You can find them anywhere. The popularity of games, you know, have risen greatly in the past 10 years. And so I'm sure that you could probably easily find a group of people playing games. But I would also suggest, you know, bring your wife with you. She would like to play some games as well.
Probably. I mean, it's like one thing that happened when we first met, which was about 5 or 6 years ago. Friends of mine, when I was single, were like, oh, come on with us. We do this Trivial Pursuit type, you know, game night every night at this one restaurant. And then she joined us. And so, you know, we won a few trophies and different things like that. So
there you go. So because of pub quizzes, you met your wife.
Yes. But what killed it, unfortunately, is what you mentioned, the COVID pandemic. And so that kind of ended it, you know, and we haven't really got back into it, even though, you know, we venture out and do things. It's just thing we haven't come back to.
Right, right. Well, you could do it at home and invite some people over and do it, you know. I used to do that as well pre-COVID. I had a pretty regular group of friends, and we were pretty good. We would, you know, usually win or get second place. We had a good time, and there were a lot of good restaurants that we would go to. So I kind of miss that. There's a lot of things. I was thinking about different hobbies that I've had over the years, and I'm like, oh man, I haven't done that in forever. I should do that again, you know?
Unfortunately, the restaurant that we were doing it at, they went out of business during the pandemic. There's now a new restaurant that just opened in the spot, but I haven't been to it yet.
I don't think they do
the game things. No.
I mean, one of the things I always recommend for people is the website Meetup, which is a really great resource for finding, you know, all types of activities, but board gaming groups in particular. Myself, I have a couple of groups that I go to on a regular basis through Meetup. So it's now that the world is opening up a lot more, people are feeling safer about getting out there. Now myself, I just went through a bone marrow transplant, which means I have the immunity system of a baby. And so I can't go out in public for at least, the minimum is 100 days, and I'm only on day 45. So I still have another 55 days to go before I can actually interact with other humans. Right. So I'm, I kind of went from COVID to cancer to bone marrow transplant. So I've had a few years where I haven't been able to get out and do all the things that I like to do yet. So soon. Right. I'm literally counting the days.
Although this just reminded me, I had forgotten this, but during the peak of the pandemic, I guess, is when everybody really was home all the time. A friend of mine did do a different trivia type thing over the internet, and we had these different teams and everything like that, you know. And by being teams, I mean, we didn't have 30 people here in my place, you know. We were all over the country, but we were a team, you know, competing. But man, it's like, unlike the one that I was doing in the restaurant prior to the pandemic, this guy's questions were hard. You know, and only once did we come close to even winning, and we still were like in fourth or fifth place. There was like 10 teams, and it was mainly because the team that usually won didn't show up that week.
Yeah.
But anyway,
did you find that digital version as satisfying as doing it at the pub?
In a certain respect, yes, because, you know, you still got to talk to people just like we're talking to people. So we're all online just like this with a Zoom, you know, but instead of just two squares, there was like 50 squares of just, and so, you know, everybody had to kind of take their turn and keep quiet unless they were revealing an answer or something like that, you know. Otherwise it was chaos online, you know, but, you know, it seemed to work. And
that's good. Well, at least you had that, you know, to keep you occupied.
Yeah. And I think we were doing that for about 6 months, and then it just kind of petered out or something as things were starting to change. But, you know,
I'd forgotten
about that. Yeah, but you know, I do have an interest in games, and my wife does too. It's just, you know, we go through peaks and valleys, so it's like now I think it's like we're kind of like, what else is out there?
There's plenty out there. That's the good news.
Yeah.
Another thing you might want to check out is maybe there's some sort of gaming cafe nearby, right? There are two.
You know, one of them actually uses your book title.
There you go.
It's called Level Up, you know. And so when I saw that, I said, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. The other one is called, it's not called this, but I always call it the Barcade. There's two in town.
Oh, right. You know, where it has video games and stuff.
Yeah, they have video games. They have pinball machines, but you can drink a beer while you're playing. Right. So it's
there's a couple of those here in LA, and I quite enjoy those. I like a good pinball game, so I'll. But it's a bit of a drive for me. It's like a 2-hour drive for me to get to it. So I have to be in the neighborhood in order to do it.
Mm-hmm. But ours aren't too far away. But it's the same thing like everything else. It's like COVID hit, and it's like, you know, it's like I ease back into certain things that I used to do. And I'm going out to restaurants and things like that. I just haven't incorporated all the entertainment things I used to do.
Right. So, yeah. You're slowly edging yourself back into the world.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to show you, since you mentioned Pac-Man, is my only foray into video games as far as the books I write. I typically write books about comic books and animation and stuff like that, but I got the assignment to write Pac-Man, the first animated TV show based on a video game.
Oh, nice.
And
I was going to say, when I was working on Pac-Man World, we talked to the folks at Namco and said, hey, can we use anything from the TV show? And they're like, absolutely not. We don't like that show.
And, you know, I did write a little bit about your game in there.
Nice.
Not too much, because I was mainly focusing on the cartoon show.
Sure,
but,
sure.
You know, I did mention that very fact that there was a few names that were kept from the TV show, but the character design completely different. And
I'm sure we probably stole a couple of names from the show or something like that. But the thing was, you know, Pac-Man was kind of, at the time, this was in the late 90s when we did this game, Pac-Man had kind of, you know, was passe, right? Like there hadn't been a game in a while, and it was his 20th anniversary, so Namco was like, we want to do something. Mm-hmm. And we're like, you know, we have to bring this game into the modern times, because all the other games were, you know, 2D. And there's one that's really weird that's called, it's not Pac-Land. It is like the New Adventures of Pac-Man or something like that. And it's like you literally are throwing rocks at Pac-Man to get him to do things in the game. And it's bizarre. And and so we were like, well, you know, as much as we like how crazy this game is, we can't do that. You know, so we at the time, games like Crash Bandicoot and Mario 64 were very popular. So we made a 3D Pac-Man. It was the first 3D model of the Pac-Man. And made that our character. And then, you know, and then the challenge became, well, how do you make a maze? Like, how do you make it feel like a maze if you have wider than a single lane? Because the traditional maze, you know, you would just run down a single lane and the ghost would, you know, if you went the wrong way, the ghost, you get got by the ghost. So we had those in the game to kind of satisfy the fans, like I was talking about, right? You got to make sure that the fans are happy. But we also were trying to incorporate that, like to make it feel like you had that type of gameplay, but in this wider, what we called 2.5D environment. And I guess we ended up being successful because it ended up selling a ton of copies and doing really well.
Yeah. And that's the one thing that, you know, it was a strange assignment because I'm not the hugest video game person per se, but you know, what had happened is published by Bear Manor Media, which is my main publisher, and Ben had a small child at the time, which I think she's about a teenager now, but, and for some reason loved video games, but also loved that Hanna-Barbera Pac-Man show. And in my lifetime growing up, you know, Pac-Man, the cartoon show, was about the time I dropped off and wasn't watching Saturday morning. I was aware of it.
But you're like, this is too dumb. I can't. It was about the same for me. I was like, you know, discovering Dungeons and Dragons and video games, and you know, I was not interested in, you know, animated Pac-Man show.
Right. So, you know, I stomached it, swallowed my pride, you know, drank a few cups of coffee, and said, "All right, let's watch these things." You know, it's still typical early 80s animations, kind of clunky and everything like that, but there's some moments in it, and I do talk about it in the book, and so I was kind of pleasantly surprised it wasn't as wretched as it could have been, you know.
I had a similar experience with SpongeBob, which is when I was given the assignment to work on the SpongeBob games, I was like, oh my god, this stuff is, you know, this is stuff for small children and stone college kids, you know, it's not for me. Yeah. And I ended up watching them. I watched like the whole first series, and I'm like, wow, this is a pleasant surprise. It's not anywhere near as dumb or annoying as I thought it would be. Now, granted, there's some things that are dumb and annoying about it, but compared to where my expectations were, I was really surprised. And that's back to that idea of like, you really need to find out what the fans like, right? So there, you know, you're writing this book about Pac-Man essentially for this 14-year-old girl who loves the show. And so you got to make sure you're not coming into it of like, oh, this is crap, this is garbage. You need to find what's good about it, and then bring that to the surface and go, yeah, this show actually does have some good stuff in it. And it's worthy of writing a whole book about.
Yeah. And what helped me on writing is I said, you know, I don't know if you do this with your books, but it sounds like you do, is like, You even though you're writing for your audience, you're in a certain way writing for yourself. You know, you want to put stuff in there that you want to see. So it's like, I took the opportunity to do a basic Hanna-Barbera history. I also took the opportunity to do basic video game history. Because, you know, I mentioned Pong, but, you know, it's like, and I played Asteroids and all those different things. And it's like, but who did what? Where did it come from? And so I had to do a little research for that. So that was kind of actually more interesting for me, just where they came from. And then you find out little things, which I kind of knew anyway, like the guy who founded Atari also founded Chuck E. Cheese, you know, things like that. You know? And, you know.
Yeah. There's, I mean, first of all, video game history is fascinating. I taught for many years, and one of my favorite classes I would teach was video game history. The thing I would always tell the students, I'm like, look, guys, I grew up with this. You're going to get a firsthand account of what it was like, because I remember playing Pong at a gym that my parents went to, because there were no such things as arcades. There was just Pong machines at weird various, you know, in bars and restaurants and gyms and things like that. And then all of a sudden you start seeing these other games kind of start creeping in. And then eventually somebody says, hey, let's put them all in one place. And that's where an arcade came from, right? So so I've had the pleasure, and I also had the pleasure of meeting a few of the people that, you know, I met the creator of Galaga, and I've met, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto, and I've met Nolan Bushnell, and, you know, people like that. I've been able to, you know, get some of their point of view of what, you know, had a chance to ask them a question or two. And I think that as authors, getting that history in there, because it gives great context, right? The reader now understands why it's so important and why Pac-Man fever was, you know, and how it was everywhere, and why somebody would want to make a cartoon show out of it, you know, makes perfect sense.
And, you know, it really was the first cartoon show, because people say, well, wasn't there a Donkey Kong show or Qbert show? And I go, they all came after, you know, like the year is like a year later, but you know, it's still, you know,
Pac-Man led the way in a lot of ways. And I'm very proud to be a part of the Pac-Man lineage. What's funny is people will say, I say I work on a Pac-Man game, and they'll say, you invented Pac-Man? I'm like, no. I would laugh. I said, no, I designed the 16th Pac-Man game.
Yeah.
So, there were many, many other Pac-Man games before mine. But I am very proud of the one that I helped create. I think that it's still to this day. What's really nice was that remake that came out really proved that our game design still held up, you know, that they were what they were like, oh, it's, you know, we did that game in 2099, I think it came out.
So, well, Pac-Man's now 40 years old.
Right. You know, so yeah, but I mean, our game itself was like, I think our game was like 20 years old, even though we were celebrating the 20th anniversary. And the fact that they, you know, they were like, Namco was like, hey, that was a good game, let's put it out again, to me speaks volumes to you know, the quality of the game that we made, that it's still fun and still playable and all that.
Okay.
You can't escape yet, because you mentioned that you like comic books.
I am also
a huge comic book fan and collector. My main is Batman and all things Batman related, but I also have very deep loves of things like Alpha Flight and the 1985 run of Amazing Spider-Man, which in my opinion might be the greatest year of Spider-Man, not counting the Lee Ditko stuff. I have been a constant comic book reader since before I learned how to read, but a Wednesday go to the comic shop guy since probably 1984 or so.
Now, do you still buy titles now?
I go if I can, you know, granted right now I'm not really allowed to go out and,
well, you know, what I mean,
pretty much every Wednesday, or, you know, whatever the day for release day was, and I still love going to my local comic store. Because I love not only picking up the stuff, you know, that I am addicted to, but also I love browsing the stacks, and, you know, I'll often pick up, you know, twice as many, you know, I'll go in to buy like three or four books, and I'll come out with 10 or 20, because I'm like, oh, this looks good. This looks good. Oh, I like this character. You know, Hobgoblin, who's my favorite Marvel villain, you know, just showed up recently in a Miles Morales comic, and I, you know, I'm okay about Miles. I, you know, he's not my Spider-Man, but I know that people love him. But Hobgoblin showed up recently, and I'm like, well, I gotta see what my boy is up to. So you know, I buy the book, right?
Right. Okay.
So what are some of your favorites, Mark?
Well, I mean, it's like at this point, it's kind of weird. That's why I was asking if you find things, but you know, it's like I understand people still collect current titles. Actually, the weirdest thing now is that I'm kind of playing catch up, because Marvel Masterworks came out years ago with all these hardback editions and the big omnibuses and everything. And it's like, you know, I've always been like, these cost so much. And so I've been very selective, meaning like buying one or two here and there.
Well, and they're so big too. They're hard to handle.
But about 2 years ago, they started reissuing them in these little paperback volumes. Digest, like $16. And it's like, there's my price. And so, you know, I've been getting all those. And so that's really what I'm collecting now. The other thing is, I love the EC stuff, the old EC stuff. Yeah, and there's two paths you can go, and I bought a little bit of both, is the Dark Horse path and the Fantagraphics path. So I'm buying those. But I have, you know, all the issues when they were reissued back in the 90s, you know, and Russ Cochran and Jim Stone and Gladstone or whatever did them all, you know.
I'm a huge Wally Wood fan. And and the one thing that I've never pulled the trigger on that I regret is the old collections of like Weird Science and Weird Fantasy and all that, you know, all the books that he did artwork for, because his work is just gorgeous. I think he's, you know, he's right up in my book. He's right up there with the best, you know, he's up there with the Neil Adams and the Jack Kirby's and the, you know, what he did was so unique and so amazing, particularly at the time. You know, you look at his work compared to a lot of his peers, and he's like head and shoulders above most of them.
Well,
I think maybe only Eisner and Kirby match his level of storytelling and artistry.
Well, if you don't mind the coloring, I mean, because some people do the new Dark Horse coloring, the paperback versions of the Weird Science, they give you 6 old issues for $20, which isn't bad.
That's great.
So you can get the entire series. I think there's 4 volumes of Science, 4 volumes of Fantasy, and then 3 of the Weird, or 2 or 3 of the Weird Science Fantasy. So, you know, you get the whole thing for like a couple hundred,
which is about the amount of money you would pay for one issue of those, you know, one of those books, in good condition,
or more if it's
or depending on the book, right? If it's, you know, if it has a good cover, that's gonna, you know, run you in the thousands.
Or
that's another thing,
story that, like My World or something, you know, like
right that, yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly, yeah. The I mean, the other thing that I've been kind of doing is I have been going back, and so my run of Batman starts in 1963 or 1964 with the what's known as the new look, right? So I that's when I decided to, like, I'm gonna own everything from, you know, 60. That predates my birth by about 4 years. It's, you know, around the time when the Batman TV show was being developed, all that. So so I have everything from that forward to literally to today. But there are stuff that I want to go back at, like there's certain covers that I like or stories that I like. And there's certain things that I just will never probably ever be able to afford, like a Batman number one or, or maybe even a Batman, you know, 16, the one where he's punching out the Joker on the cover, because they're, those are in the thousands. But if it's something that's relatively affordable, I'll pick it up. And so I've got now what I hope, what I think is a pretty nice little selection, you know, maybe about 8 or 9 books that are I'm fond of. And so, but the real fun thing has been when I go to shows is my younger brother is a big Spider-Man collector, and he's got everything from 2 to now, or when they stop, I think it was like 300 and something. So he's got all that, but for a while he was trying to get the low numbers. And so when I would go to comic book conventions, I would essentially be like a buyer for him. And I would go and look and look at the quality and say, hey, this looks pretty good. You know, how much? And can you go lower? And, you know, and then I would put him on the phone. I'm like, you know, here's my brother, the buyer, you know, you could talk to him about it. And and so sometimes I would pick up stuff for him and, you know, ship it to him or whatever. And so I'm not much of a really old, you know, collector. But I sometimes play one.
Well, another thing, and you probably have seen these if you're going every Wednesday, is the current trend to reissue older books.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Those ads and everything.
Those replica issues. Yeah, I've been picking up a ton of those, to be honest. Yeah. And the irony is I own most of them. But but I'm like, well, this is a copy I can read. But the other thing I've noticed is that those are going up in price too.
Yeah.
Like the Spider-Man, now what's the number where he's got the black suit?
252. Yeah.
Like that reprint of 252 is already like $20.
Yeah.
For like what's a $6-7 book. Yeah. You know, so it's like, that's crazy. You know, that's
those EC reprints when they did them in the 90s, you know, they got Crime Suspense Stories 22. You know, some people are selling the reprint for close to 50, right. $75, you know, and it's like, you know, well, it's less than what an original would be, but still it's like, well,
yeah, I've got other reprints of, you know, Batman number ones and Action Comics number ones and things like that. Like there was in the 2000s, there was what was called the Millennium series, and it was a reprints, but they had kind of a different, they had like a cover of the book, but then they also kind of had some trade dress around it. And those books, I was shocked to see, like, those were going for, like, there were a couple that were going for a couple $100. That was, I mean, maybe that was somebody that was out of their mind that was trying to get $100 for them. But I was like, again, it was like, these were, you know, $2 books back in, '99, 2000, right?
Right.
And reprints, you know, of stuff that it's not even like the original thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the whole comic book industry, I think what happened recently is I think with COVID and NFTs, you know, those non-fungible tokens, I think that when those started to fail, people turned to comic books as an alternative, because comic books are, you know, they're real, they're tangible, they're something you can hold on to. There are those people that like to slab them. You know, I'm not a fan of that myself. Yeah. I like to have the idea that I could one day, like, you know, read my, if I ever had a Batman number one, that I could read it, you know, with my kid gloves on and some sort of rebreather to make sure I don't sully it with my, you know, my breath and my
finger,
my, yeah, exactly. My filthy hands. But, I think that just in the past few years, people have looked at that as like, hey, this is a way that we could maybe invest, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's, you know, I also like it now that they're reprinting. I mean, you could probably make any issue a key issue, but they're not reprinting. You know, I get tired when it's just always Batman number one. I mean, they've done like Batman number five, you know.
Yeah, but they had a nice foil version of Batman number one.
Yeah,
it was gorgeous.
But I mean, it's nice to see, you know, like I've been a proponent, and they probably won't ever do this. It's just do some series. Well, they kind of did when we were younger. It's like when they did like Marvel Tales and reprinted all that. That's how I read Ditko Spider-Man originally.
Sure,
and they did it consecutively.
And classic X-Men, right?
That was another really good series. I wish they'd just reissue them just consecutively. They could have just the big titles again, Fantastic Four.
I think it's because they see the money in the trades, you know, so they're pushing the trades. They're
Which
getting
is
to buy
I
those,
am getting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, those little paperbacks or the masterworks or stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, what I find annoying as a comic book fan is the fact that so many people are so quick to label something a key issue, you know, and drive up the price. You know, they're doing it mainly just to, as far as speculators' perspective, but yeah, that drives me a little nuts when they do that. But that said, I do love that the DC and Marvel in particular, you know, DC in particular is publishing some books that, you know, the first issue of Riddler, you know, but then you also get all the crazy other stuff in the issue. You know, I love just as much reading, you know, the backstories or the secondary stories or whatever, you know, like they, you know, the comics back in those days were 8, you know, 10 page stories. And so they had to fill, you know, 20, 30 pages of content. And so you would get, you know, weird, you know, Martian Manhunter stories or Roy Raymond, the TV detective, or, you know, or even back in the really old days, you would get fiction, right? You would get little 2-page stories or things like that, you know? And that's why I love these, you know, direct reproductions, because you get, you know, the collected editions, you know, I own, you know, God knows how many like greatest Batman stories ever told that have this, you know, mostly the same. You know, if I ever see The Laughing Fish or Joker's 5-Way Revenge or The Origin of Batman reprinted again, I'll lose my mind.
Right.
But if I can get the book with the ads and the letter page and
the letter page,
or the other backstories in it, then I'm like, yeah, I really enjoy this. You know, to me, it's a lot of fun. But the other thing that I love about them is that I have a board game design that I've been working on, and I actually have a patent on this, which is a board game that turns any comic book ever published into a board game. So you could bust out your, go to the comic store on Wednesday and buy the latest comic, and you could play it on that. Or you could bust open your copy of Action Comics number one and play a board game on that. You know, whatever. It literally has, it turns the language of, because I'm such a big comic book fan, I understand, and I've created comics myself, I understand the language of comics. And so I've able to turn the language of comics into a board game. And so this is something that I've been working on for many, you asked how many years does it take to make a board game? Well, this one I've been working on for many years, but I have this patent now, so it's protecting this idea. And that's something that's a rarity. Usually you don't patent board games. But I talked to three lawyers and they all said, you need the patent. So I said, all right, who am I to argue with three lawyers?
It's a great idea.
What's also great about it is you can go to your dollar bin and drop 10 bucks on 10 books, and now you have 10 different, entirely different board games, right? One of the things, you know, that I there's some things that I'm still kind of like, well, do I need to get, you know, do I need to partner up with a DC or a Marvel or an Image or somebody like that, or should I just put it out there and then kind of hopefully let it, you know, grow. That's one of the decisions that I'm still trying to decide. So whether I kickstart it or go with a publisher or something like that. But otherwise I love playing it. It's a very interesting system, if I do say so myself. And so I'm hoping that hopefully within the next year or two, I can kind of bring it to market.
Very cool. That was actually one of my questions, but you already answered it. You know, what are you working on now? So that sounds like one thing.
That was called Comic Book Crisis is the current name. Whether that stays or not, we'll see. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a couple of things. Like I said, there was that one design that I was asked to do. I have to check back with them and see if that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm currently on, if you go to my Facebook page, which is just Scott Rogers, I was dealing with cancer in the fall, mm-hmm. and as a exercise to kind of keep my mind from, you know, going crazy, I designed a board game. But I said, I'm going to make a game. I'm only going to make 20 or 12 copies of them. And it's going to be about ghosts and a haunted house, and it's going to involve dice. That's all I know about. And so I got 12 people to donate money, or, you know, to not donate, but to buy in on this idea, essentially like a Kickstarter without kickstarting. And so I designed this game, and I part of the exercise was I wanted to learn how to deal with factories, like factories in China or wherever that made components for board games. So I reached out to a couple of companies. One made the board, one made a meeple for the game. I put it together, and it's called Escape from Marauder Manor or Mansion. And it you can find it on Board Game Geek, which is a really great website for board games. So this was like a bespoke, rare, only 12 of these exist. Because I'm still dealing with this, you know, my own kind of personal lockdown, I'm like, well, I had a good time doing that other game. Let me do it again. Mm-hmm. So this time I have a game that I'm making, and I'm only making 20 copies of it. Mm-hmm. And it involves a little wind up. I'll show you. It involves a little wind up Godzilla dinosaur character like this. Mm-hmm. That's the randomizer in the game that it's going to wander around and cause havoc. And my working title for it is "Oh No, There Goes Tokyo." And we'll see whether that sticks or not. But 19 out of 20 of the spots have been taken. So I don't know when this is going to air, but maybe if one of your listeners hustles over to my Facebook page, they can buy in on this game, which I'm currently in the process of developing. And we'll probably have it come out to the buyers in the summer.
Very cool. Okay.
And then I have two other games coming out. One called Diamonds and Dinosaurs. That's coming out pretty soon. And another one called Castle Climbers, but that probably won't be out till the fall or winter.
Okay. And then I guess plug your books again one more time.
Yeah. So Level Up, The Guide to Great Video Game Design. Swipe This, The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design. And Your Turn, The Guide to Great... Oh, I'm sorry. Swipe This is Touchscreen Game Design. And Your Turn, The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design. They're all published by Wiley Books, the same people who do the Four Dummies books, if you know those. They are all available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your favorite local bookstore owner. Ask for it by name. And don't forget, if you read it and enjoy it, don't forget to write a review, because reviews really help authors. Right, Mark? Just yes. Like your Pac-Man book. Getting a review for your book is the greatest feeling in the world.
Yes. And I know you're kind of in hibernation, as it were, right now. Yep. But any convention appearances or signings or anything in the future?
I would love to make it to Gen Con. I don't know if that's going to be possible or not. I probably won't start to emerge until the fall. So I've been looking at shows like Board Game Geek Con. Or maybe even if I can swing at San Diego Comic Con, and they're going to have a pretty big board game presence there this year, which is really fun to see, because I've been going to that show since I was 8 or 9, I've almost never missed a show. So I'm looking forward to getting back to Comic Con.
All right. Well, continued success with all your books and your projects and games and your health. You know,
thank you.
And you know, it was a pleasure having you on the show, Scott. And
Mark, anytime. I'd be happy to come back and talk. You know, we barely scratched the surface on some of this stuff, so I would love to come back and nerd out with you on some other fun things.
Sounds good. Okay, and that wraps up another episode of Fun Ideas Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Arnold, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Scott Rogers, for being my special guest. Remember, you can always watch the video version of this episode on YouTube. Episode number 258 will be coming soon. If you would like to comment and or be a guest on this podcast, please drop me a line at funideas.mark@gmail.com. Become a free subscriber or a paying Patreon at Mark Arnold Fun Ideas Productions. If everyone listening just contributed $1 a month, it would be a tremendous help in continuing the production of my books and this podcast. The opening and closing music for this podcast is provided by Elmo and Almo. This has been the Fun Ideas Podcast. This has been Mark Arnold speaking. This episode is copyright 2024 Fun Ideas Productions. Thank you and good night.
If you're unhappy most of the time, and you're indoors when the sun begins to shine, you're